Hello there. Today is Thursday, October the 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, some of the president's closest allies are speaking out against his decision to pull out of Syria.
The Kurds are in a world of hurt, and ISIS comes back, and President Trump will own it.
The White House is ramping up its strategy of not cooperating with a Democratic-led impeachment inquiry. And a cardigan sweater, a guitar, and much more owned by one of the most influential grunge rockers are all heading to auction. It's all on today's International Edition. Turkey launched airstrikes, fired artillery, and began a ground offensive against Kurdish fighters in northern Syria Wednesday after U.S. troops pulled back from the area, paving the way for an assault on forces that have been long allied with the U.S. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced the start of the campaign, which followed the abrupt decision Sunday by U.S. President Donald Trump to essentially abandon the Syrian Kurdish fighters, leaving them vulnerable to a Turkish offensive that was widely condemned around the world. The decision was a major shift in U.S. policy and drew opposition from all sides at home and abroad, including some of the president's strongest supporters like Senator Lindsey Graham.
It would be hard to protect America without allies over there, and the Kurds have been good allies. And when Turkey goes into Syria, they're not going in to fight ISIS. They're going in to kill the Kurds because in their eyes, they're more of a threat to Turkey than ISIS.
It also marked a stark change in rhetoric by Trump, who during a press conference in New York last year vowed to stand by the Kurds, who have been America's only allies in Syria fighting the Islamic State group. Trump said at the time that the Kurds fought with us and died with us and insisted that America would never forget. Well, joining us to talk more about it is Dr. Howard Eisenstadt, associate professor at St. Lawrence University and a senior non-resident fellow at the Project on Middle East Democracy. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Eisenstadt. This is all happening very fast with Turkey moving into northern Syria so fast after the president's decision. What is your reaction to all of it?
President Trump has been frustrated with overextension of U.S. troops overseas and in the Middle East in particular for a long time, I think very reasonably. He was committed to the destruction of ISIS, but has, I think, wrongly understood the end of ISIS as a territorial entity as the end of ISIS as a military threat. And we know from President Trump that he typically doesn't listen to his experts and that he takes very seriously his personal relationships with often strongmen overseas. He's developed a very strong relationship with President Erdogan of Turkey. Despite tensions between the two countries, he sees Erdogan as somebody he can do business with. And so when President Erdogan says, I want to go into Syria, you get out of the way. For Trump, that was effectively an excuse to do something that he had wanted to do for a long time, namely to pull troops out. In fact, he hasn't pulled troops out. He's merely let Turkish troops in. The U.S. troops have not left Syria. They've moved to other parts of Syria. And the cost of this has been tremendous. We're effectively deserting a group that has been working with us very closely in the fight with ISIS. The conflict with ISIS has not ended. Our reputation as people who will stand with our comrades in arms has been fundamentally undermined. And the question is, what is the United States gaining from it? And that is not clear.
Right. I would think that this would potentially do the opposite, that people would have a hard, or our allies, if we need them, would have a hard time believing.
Turkey is an ally too. And there's an argument to be made that our relationship with the Kurds, the YPG in Syria, has undermined that alliance. I think that that's reasonable. But the truth is that Syria is working in tangent with the Assad regime and Russia at this particular juncture, that our actions here are empowering our adversary. If not Turkey, then certainly Russia, Iran, the Assad regime have all been empowered by this. Our capacity to fight ISIS has been undermined. And so it's really unclear how we can benefit and what the advantages for the United States are.
This hasn't been a secret what the Turkish leader has wanted to do in Syria. So it's not like this was unexpected if the U.S. Allowed them to come in and start slaughtering the Kurds.
I mean, I don't think it's simply slaughtering the Kurds. They are attacking a Kurdish militia group that we have been working in tangent with. Not simply an ethnic conflict. It's a political one. But you're absolutely right. They've wanted to do this for a long time. In fact, President Trump offered them the opportunity to do so about a year ago, and that was why General Mattis stepped down over that particular decision, and Trump was forced to backtrack. But very clearly, he did so unwillingly, mm-hmm. and he saw this as an opportunity to go back to that original policy.
What does it say that the president made the decision shortly after he got off the phone with President Erdogan and then didn't consult with national security, military, Pentagon?
Look, President Trump doesn't trust his experts. This is not unusual for him. And this is in parallel to him talking about Russian meddling in U.S. elections and him saying, well, Putin tells me it didn't happen, even as the entire mm-hmm. intelligence apparatus has told him it has. He takes these relationships with authoritarian leaders more seriously than he appears to take his own generals and intelligence officers.
Will this whole situation potentially do more damage than anything else has as far as politically with his own allies?
It certainly doesn't serve him well. It also doesn't serve him well politically at home. A bipartisan bill is moving through the Senate that calls for pretty draconian sanctions on Turkey that would, if it passes, put President Trump in a very difficult situation. I think that a situation where he's burning bridges with his own party, with his allies, is not one that he wants to do during a potential impeachment trial. But the larger issue is that whatever the implications for Trump, it puts U.S. interests at risk, and it results in tremendous human suffering for people who have been fighting with us.
All right. That is Dr. Howard Eisenstadt, Associate Professor at St. Lawrence University and Senior Non-Resident Fellow at the Project on Middle East Democracy. Well, the White House is officially stonewalling Congress. Attorneys sent a letter vowing to defy what it calls an illegitimate impeachment inquiry and refuse to honor subpoenas or allow testimony. The Trump administration came under fire after a whistleblower complaint filed by a CIA officer suggested Trump and other administration officials worked to withhold aid from Ukraine and pushed the country's government to investigate the son of Democratic rival Vice President Joe Biden. On Wednesday, Biden fought back and for the first time publicly agreed with the impeachment inquiry.
He believes he can and will get away with anything he does. We all laughed when he said he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and get away with it. It's no joke. He's shooting holes in the Constitution, and we cannot let him get away with it.
Trump is known to be a fighter, and he took aim right back at Biden, saying he's desperate.
I guess this is one way he can do it. You know, he didn't say that until right now, and he sees what's happening to him. I guess he's no longer the front runner. But look, I feel badly for him because I know he's going through a lot.
Well, Trump again defended his decision not to cooperate, calling a whistleblower's complaint about his call to Ukraine's leader a fraud being perpetrated by on the American public and saying Republicans are being treated unfairly. A letter sent to House leaders by White House counsel Tuesday evening declared the president would not cooperate with the investigation, which is a clear reason, Democrats say, to write an article of impeachment charging him with obstruction. Joining us to talk all about it, of all of this, is Professor of Governmental Affairs at George Mason University Schar School of Policy and Government, Robert Deitz. Thank you for being with us. What do you think the White House, why do you think the White House has decided that not cooperating is their best strategy to fight this?
It could be. It's also possible, while they realize that they've got some exculpatory evidence, that you can't say, look, we'll cooperate with witness A, B, and C, but not witness X, Y, and Z. And so I think the decision is, let's just prevent any evidence from emanating from the White House or the State Department or wherever going up to Capitol Hill.
But could that cause bigger problems for them? Because the Democrats are certainly saying that they will just consider this obstruction. We know that impeachments have been voted on because of that very issue alone.
See, I'm not sure they have an alternative strategy. I mean, when I think about these issues, I think about them, of course, as a lawyer, and I try to put myself in their shoes and say, what would I do? And I'm not sure they have a better strategy. The claim that could lawfully lead to impeachment is out there, and it was perfected by the president when he admitted all the material facts. That is, he had a conversation with the Ukraine president, and at some point he asked him to do me a favor. And that all by itself would provide grounds for impeachment. So stonewalling adds to the concerns of basically saying, you're not going to help us, then that's obstruction, and that's, we'll just add that as another count in our list of impeachable offenses.
Well, since this whole thing started with the whistleblower complaint and the subsequent call for an impeachment inquiry by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the president came out right on the White House lawn and pretty much did the same thing, calling on China to now investigate Joe Biden, his political rival. It was right there in front of everyone. So what do you say to his political allies who continue to say he's done nothing wrong and this is just basically calling it a kangaroo court? Just calling it all kinds of names and trying to discredit this.
Sure. I mean, you notice that in all the statements that come out of the White House, none of them is on the merits. They're all the sort of, you know, so's your mother, you know, your mother wears combat boots, the kind of thing that the 5- and 6-year-olds say to each other. But none of them ever says, no, the president's completely innocent, blah, blah, blah. They never dispute, and it's hard to dispute what the president himself conceded when he released the MemCon. Again, in trying to figure out what could a defense counsel say to the president, I think the best they can come up with is, we're not going to help. So what are the alternatives for the Democrats on the House side? Well, it seems to me there are two. One is, of course, go to court. And that would be very interesting to see, you know, if the court ordered, and, you know, assume it went up the line to the Supremes, and the court said, no, you've got no privilege here. You've got to release this information. You've got to allow this testimony. What would the president do? I mean, he's defied one branch. Would he defy a second branch? That's sort of alternative one. Alternative two, I think I've suggested it to your listeners in the past, is to send out the Capitol Police under the authority of the Speaker of the House and arrest people for civil contempt who are officials to whom they want to speak.
Is he required by law to turn over the information they request?
Yes. Absolutely. The arguments that were put out are preposterous. Notice he said he wants a number of people impeached. Well, congressmen and senators are not impeached. It makes one wonder if he's ever read the Constitution. But the other thing, they were talking about the president's civil liberties are being challenged. He's being denied protections and so on. The impeachment article makes it very clear that this is a matter for the House of Representatives, and that's the complete set of requirements. So all this other stuff is just sort of fog that's put out there by the White House.
What about the president continuing to go after the whistleblower, saying things like this person is a partisan,
a traitor,
they've got conflict of interest, but they don't know who the whistleblower is, even though they say they would like to, unless there's something we don't know here.
No, the whistleblower's identity, everybody claims it's not known, and I accept that claim because whistleblowers are generally protected. The president is making this up as he goes along. Again, what's he going to say? Oh, yeah, the whistleblower's a great guy. I mean, he's certainly not going to say that, so what can he say? All he can do is accuse.
So where does it all go from here? Can they do this impeachment inquiry and potential vote without cooperation?
Yes. If I were in charge of things on the Hill, what I would do is have a two-track strategy. First, I would go to the courts and seek, emergency kind of resolution. And that can be done. You can get decisions on this kind of an issue actually quite quickly. Now that the Supreme Court's in session, that could all be adjudicated quite quickly, well before the election. So that would be track one. Simultaneously, I'd move forward with the evidence that they already have and seek to interview people that are not under the control of the executive branch, people who are retired and so on, and then see what evidence they've got and then put it before a House vote.
All right. Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. Two people have been murdered in an attack on a Jewish synagogue on its holiest day of the Jewish year. The Kremlin labels an opposition-led foundation a foreign agent. Africa Biometrics plan is raising concerns about abuses. And can virtual reality prevent cognitive decline and dementia? Find expanded coverage of all these stories and lots more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. In Hong Kong, protests that erupted nearly 4 months ago to oppose a controversial extradition law have evolved into a disruptive pro-democracy movement, which has led to increasingly violent clashes between protesters and police. VOA's Brian Padden reports on how Hong Kong got to this point and the serious challenge it poses to China's rule over this former British colony.
Hong Kong is in the midst of an uncompromising standoff between increasingly defiant pro-democracy protesters and equally determined government forces backed by Beijing.
We will do it again and again until the government will break down.
The root of the current conflict dates back to 1997 when China agreed to allow Hong Kong a semi-autonomous government for at least 50 years after it took back control of the former British colony. The one country, two systems model allows popular elections for about half the legislature, but other seats are selected by elites with business interests in China, and Beijing appoints the Hong Kong chief executive. More recently, in 2014, the Umbrella Revolution demonstrations shut down business districts in the city for months over growing concerns that China, under President Xi Jinping, is seeking to undermine the independence and civil liberties in Hong Kong. This year in March, protests again erupted over a proposed extradition bill that critics said would erode the independent judiciary of Hong Kong and subject critics of mainland China to increased risk of arrest. In August, concerns mounted that Beijing would intervene after Chinese riot police conducted exercises in nearby Shenzhen. But so far, the military has stayed on the sidelines. Protesters have employed increasingly disruptive and destructive tactics, vandalizing businesses and the city's subway system, and engaging in clashes with police. The Hong Kong government abandoned the extradition bill, but the protesters since added demands for direct popular elections. Pro-Beijing hardliners say the democracy movement's goal is to win independence from China.
One could interpret the continued protests as reflecting that goal. I don't, but I can see how Beijing would.
Police have used increasing force to quell the protests, employing water cannons, rubber bullets, and tear gas. During massive protests held to spoil China's Communist Party anniversary, a police officer for the first time shot a protester with lethal ammunition. Hong Kong leaders have increasingly focused on the radical elements in the protest movement as a threat to public safety and recently banned protesters from wearing masks in public.
We are particularly concerned that many students are participating in these violent protests or even riots, jeopardizing their safety and even their future.
Protesters have vowed to continue their struggle for democracy while the Hong Kong leadership promises further emergency measures if public order is not soon restored. Brian Padden, VOA News, Hong Kong.
Kenyan farmers in central Kenya are abandoning food crops to grow a bushy green stimulant locally referred to as muguka. Farmers say they make thrice as much selling the legal stimulant as compared to what they made while growing food crops such as maize and beans. As erratic weather conditions continue to wreak havoc on the country, more farmers are now banking on the green gold as a better alternative, with analysts fearing a potential food crop shortage in the region. Rael Ombur reports from Embu.
41-year-old Wilkiston Jerry grows muguka at a farm in Embu County in central Kenya. It is a crop that puts food on the table and will provide, she hopes, the money to send her 18-year-old son to college next year. She used to farm maize, but it was not profitable. She says she used 5,000 Kenya shillings to plow. She bought fertilizer worth 3,000 Kenya shillings and two bags of maize, one which cost 700 Kenya shillings. Everything, she says, cost her 10,000 Kenya shillings, but she did not harvest anything. She says the rains were little, and that happened for about two seasons. Wilkista cleared her maize and planted mogoka in two of her three-acre farm. She now makes on average 20,000 Kenya shillings, or about $190 a week. Mogoka is a variety of cut that is green and bushy. It is a stimulant that produces a mild high when chewed. The crop is fast growing and does well in the semi-arid lowlands of Embu County, making it less vulnerable to erratic weather conditions. Farmers with a lot of land used to grow mogoka, but now small-scale farmers are cashing in on the trade. John Mukundi is the chief executive officer of the Agriculture and Cooperative Docket in Embu County.
They are doing that because it is providing some employment, direct employment to the people that are in Mbeere region. And also, apart from employment, it is giving easy cash. People can get the money and they instantly when they sell their produce.
Embu's county government says there are now 65,000 farmers growing the crop in the region, making mogoka one of the highest income earners for the region, apart from coffee and tea. But the county government is urging farmers to create a balance between growing the herbal stimulant and food crops.
So we are giving some free supplies of seed so that we can encourage those farmers to also plant some seed, some food crops that will enhance food security and nutrition. We are also encouraging them to take the advantage of the fertilizer subsidies that we are giving them.
Small-scale mogoka farmers mainly sell the stimulant in local markets, but the crop is also transported to various parts of the country and is exported to Somalia. Farmers in the lowlands of Embu says despite efforts to boost food crops, the financial benefits of mogoka outweigh growing food, at least for now. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Embu, Kenya.
In California, high fire danger has led to major precautions. Pacific Gas and Electric says as many as 2 million people will remain without power at least through Thursday. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Pacific Gas and Electric says as many as 2 million people will remain without power at least through Thursday. The reason? Strong Santa Ana winds. The fear is electrical equipment could set off a wildfire. PG&E's Mark Manseason says they are on this.
We have helicopters, ground crews, people on the ground that will be inspecting every foot of our wires and our electrical components to make sure that there's no damage.
This means lights are out, traffic lights are out, which can make driving through an intersection a challenge. Deputy City Manager Kip Harkness in San Jose says this may not be over even when the wind threat is over.
Then at that point, it can take up to 5 days for the last customer to be restored.
Flashlights, candles, and coolers are among the hard-to-find items. I'm Ed Donahue.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Most people think of rats as dirty, disease-ridden creatures that should be avoided at all costs. But rats are proven to be highly intelligent with a keen sense of smell. For the past 20 years, a nonprofit organization in Tanzania has been taking advantage of those special attributes by training a special breed of rats to help save lives. VOA's Julie Tabot caught up with a member of their research team in Charleston, South Carolina.
Seeing a rat on a leash may seem a bit unusual, but this little critter is actually on a mission to sniff out landmines and help save lives. Scent detection rats like this are trained at APOPO, a nonprofit organization in Tanzania that teaches rats to use their sensitive noses to locate landmines.
Here you go.
Ellie Cutright is with their research team.
When the rats are working in the field and they find a landmine, they scratch on the ground, and that's how we know. We place a little marker there, and then we can go safely remove those and get rid of them.
The rats are born and raised at APOPO and trained using a click and reward system that works wonders.
He doesn't want to peel.
Working with rats at APOPO has been a perfect fit for Cutright, who has loved the frisky critters since childhood.
Everybody should know that these rats, they're not stupid, they're not terrible animals, they're really intelligent and they can be trained to do some amazing things.
Once trained, the rats work in minefields in Tanzania and other countries around the world where an estimated 110 million hidden landmines and other explosive remnants of war are at risk of exploding. Traditionally, landmine detection is done by humans and machines, but rats are more effective and cost-efficient. While they're too lightweight to set off a mine, they're still risking their lives. So these giant pouched rats are nicknamed hero rats. To date, these diligent heroes have detected more than 107,000 landmines and unexploded ordnances, freeing almost 1 million people from the threat of explosives. Cutright started working at APOPO last year after graduating with a degree in psychology from the College of Charleston in South Carolina, where VOA caught up with her during a recent visit.
I took a psychology course in my first semester here, and I just really fell in love with it. So I was just really excited by all the possibilities and what I could do.
School president Andrew Hsu is proud of the education his students receive.
We prepare them not only with the sciences they needed in order to succeed, but we give them a well-rounded liberal arts education so that they have the ability of critical thinking, creativity, collaboration, and communication.
That preparation is helping Cutright educate people every day about the hero rats she's come to adore.
I think the work that APOPO does is really important in kind of spreading the word that rats are not just a pest. They really are heroes, and they show us every day that they are worthy of that name.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Charleston, South Carolina.
The olive green cardigan that Kurt Cobain wore during Nirvana's MTV Unplugged performance and one of the late rockers' custom guitars are headed to auction. Julian's Auction said Wednesday that the sweater and a custom Fender guitar built in 1993 that Cobain used during the band's In Utero tour will be offered during a two-day auction of rock memorabilia this month. The turquoise-bodied left-handed guitar was on display for several years at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Cobain, one of the biggest stars of the grunge rock music scene of the early 1990s, was 27 years old when he killed himself on April 5, 1994. Other pieces in the auction include handwritten lyrics by Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, and Bruce Springsteen. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is VOA News.